on AM 930 WEOL.
After 4 o'clock, Bullseye on the afternoon on AM 930 WEOL. He's Matt Douglas. I'm Andy Bulbarch. You have us until 6 o'clock tonight. Then Matt grapples with Sean Bennett of the Chronicle-Telegram.
We did no grappling. We just spoke to grapplers.
Cobos and Jared Center High School Wrestling Recap, and then more tournament basketball action coming your way on the girls' side. D1 District Final, Avon Lake and Olmsted Falls, and at WEOL.com, Stream 2. Back to the boys' side, Amherst taking on North Ridgeville. We head back to the hotline, and we bring in author Jonathan Knight. Well, he's written a series of wonderful books about Cleveland sports. We're going to talk some Tribe baseball, and I want to pick his brain on a masterpiece that he put together a few years ago about the making of Major League, a movie that we all know and love. Jonathan, thank you so much for the time today. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Oh, lovely.
Doing
you
well.
Know, typical February up here in Cleveland. Temperatures
just
in the
20s. Just for a few more hours of February.
That's
right.
Right.
We're out of here.
That's right. And maybe we'll have a little more luck in March, and hopefully we'll get temperatures above the freezing mark every now and again. So,
indeed.
Well, I want to get in to your thoughts on the Tribe. As you and I were corresponding via email late last week and into the early stages of this week, I believe your exact words were, well, let's capitalize on some of the optimism surrounding the Tribe in spring training while it's still there. And, you know, this year's spring training obviously has a little bit of a different feel because there are a great deal of questions surrounding this team. I think that kind of adds a little bit more fun to the next 5 weeks here, simply because now that we are at February 28th, we are officially 1 month away from opening day. Hope springs eternal, I think, with this team, but certainly there are a lot of different questions. What are your expectations for the Tribe this season?
Well, I think that's a little bit of a dangerous game. I think that's what's really kind of hurt us, definitely last year. I feel last year really was crippled by the expectations. My goodness, after what they'd accomplished the previous 2 years, especially what toward the end of 2017, then I think the expectations were just sky high for 2018. And what you saw was a year that was not at all bad. I mean, four or five years ago, we would have killed for 91 wins in a division title. That sounds pretty good. But under the weight of the expectations of how 2017 and 16 wrapped up, 2018 looked like a disappointment, which really wasn't fair. It really was a nice season. So I'm hesitant to get too high. I don't think we're going to have that problem expectation-wise this year. I think everyone, if anything, it's going to swing the other way. I think there's a lot of people who I don't agree with it, but have sort of given up and say, well, the window of opportunity is closed. They're just trading away or letting all those familiar faces go, and whatever commodities they have, they'll trade away before the end of the year, and we're in a rebuilding mode. I don't think that's true, but I think a lot of people think that. So, but you're right. I think that this spring training, certainly over the last couple, it promises to be quite a bit more interesting because there are quite a few question marks. There's a lot of spots to fill and a lot of new faces out there to fill them. So it should be an interesting month here as we head into late March and see what kind of team takes the field in Minnesota a month from today.
Absolutely. You know, we're really excited for it. A couple of days ago, we had an Indians Radio WEOL exclusive as we had a spring training game 2 days ago. Daniel Johnson was a guy that really shined in that particular contest. He, of course, was the outfielder that came over in that Yan Gomes trade with the Washington Nationals a few months back. And you see names like that. That gets you at least a little bit excited. I think we're all anxious to see what the outfield's going to look like, what the bullpen is going to look like. But of all the moves they have made so far this offseason, I think perhaps the most intriguing one was made just a couple of days ago, signing Hanley Ramirez. Does that name excite you at all, even though he is 35?
Not really. I mean, but at the same time, I am excited because they have a real nice track record, certainly in the Terry Francona regime, of kind of finding these old veterans and squeezing one more good year out of them, whether it's Austin Jackson or Rajay Davis or guys of that ilk. So I think there's some kind of magic there. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's Cleveland. I don't know where they're able to kind of tap into it. But they have had some success and really some guys who have kind of saved their bacon these last few years, that some guys that they've managed to bring in and and fill in gaps quite nicely. So this could be another one of those. I mean, they do have that history, and so I'm excited on that level. I certainly don't have any, again, expectation that this is going to be a guy that they can rally around and expect them to be the heart of the lineup. But I think he could be a guy that plays a key role. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, yeah, because if he hits it all, there's going to be a spot for him in the middle of the order. There's no question about that. I don't think the Indians expect him to return to 2013 form, but let's just say he's even remotely close to what he was in 2016. That gives this team a great deal of pop that it doesn't currently have on paper anyhow, and even if he's just DHing. I mean, heck, the guy doesn't have to bring his glove to spring training. If he hits any remotely close to what he hit in 2016 with the Red Sox, they're going to be fine. The question then becomes, what do you do with the other guys who were in that DH first base rotation, the likes of Carlos Santana and Jake Bowers? Do one of those guys move to one of the corner outfield spots? So a lot of questions certainly come out of that. Taking a look at the bullpen, I know they've signed a few guys also. Tyler Clippard is a name that I like quite a bit. Very quietly, they've brought some really interesting names into spring training outside of Brad Head, because he's really the obvious one at this point, Jonathan. Are there some other names that you're intrigued by in this Indians bullpen?
I'm really intrigued by Adam Simber. I think I was really excited when he came over last year. I thought that he was really going to be a key piece, not just for last year, but for the future. I think that was, as much as we all kind of breathed a sigh of relief when Hand came in, he could kind of stop the bleeding that was that bullpen. Certainly at that point in the season, and really all year, it was a problem. But I'm really excited about Simber. As much as Hand is kind of a proven commodity that they need in that stopper role, I think Simber is he really intrigues me. I was real excited about that last year. So he's a guy I'm kind of looking at. But you're right, too. There's so many guys that are just parading in here that have a chance to make an impact. And again, going back to what we said at the beginning about expectations, that it's easy to forget that the bullpen was a real problem all year last year. Like, they really can't be worse. I hesitate to say that because Cleveland sports, we can always find a way to get worse. But I think that no matter what happens, the bullpen will be better in 2019 than it was in 2018. So that alone, I think, is worth a handful of victories that they didn't get last year. So I'm really optimistic in that regard, that if you kind of solidify that bullpen a little bit, that's really going to help out and maybe cover some gaps that they have now that they didn't have last year. So I think in that regard, there's reason for hope.
Author Jonathan Knight joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon, talking some Tribe, and we're going to make our way around to making of Major League, the making of the movie Major League. And, of course, if you live in the greater Cleveland area, you love this, and I think nationwide people love that movie as well. And, boy, I love this book so much. I've actually got two copies of it. I've actually got a paperback copy of it, and I've also...
Oh, you're the one. You're the one who bought your copy.
I loved it, man, from start to finish. It was just terrific, and I think there are so many elements of the making of a movie that the typical moviegoer doesn't necessarily see, and you had a lot of really interesting parts of this book that were really eye-opening, and it really kind of started right from the beginning. Charlie Sheen wrote the foreword for this book. He is clearly an electric personality. He mentions in that foreword that he is prouder of Major League than he is for Platoon. I mean, that shocked me because he won some awards for Platoon, but he said he's prouder of the success that the movie Major League had. Were you surprised at all by that?
I was surprised by that. That was one of the big things that did surprise me to hear him say that and then put it in the forward as well. Like, that's amazing because you're right. He's had some forgettable missteps in his career, but there have been some real gems. Platoon sort of topping that list. But he loves Major League more than Platoon, more than Wall Street, more than some really really respected movies. Which is surprising, but I think it just that it talks about or speaks to how much that movie resonates with us in the same way. Like, there's just such a genuine love for that movie that when you get it, you get it. And in Charlie's case, that's exactly what the situation is. And I think a lot of, from Charlie's perspective at least, is just the way that he loves Rick Vaughn, the way that he is Rick Vaughn. I mean, even now, probably even more than he was back in 1989, that he just totally connects with that character. He is that character. And that really hits home for him. So, yeah, I mean, it's surprising in a way that he would say that with some of the other things he's done in his career. But on the other hand, no, it totally checks out. That's why we love that movie, too.
Sure. I think one of the beautiful things about Charlie Sheen is he was a baseball player. He's a lover of the game of baseball. And I think that comes out of that character in an odd way as well with Rick Vaughn. I mean, he does what he has to do to become the pitcher he wants to be, right?
Oh yeah, and I think that was a huge part of the success too. That for Charlie, and the movie as a whole, but for Charlie, that he was able to just kind of roll off a log and play that character because he had played baseball. It wasn't one of those situations with many of the other actors who may have played in Little League. Almost all the actors had some familiarity with baseball and experience with baseball. Even if it was just Little League or high school or whatever. But Charlie had gone beyond that, and so it was a much more natural fit for him to be that character, and that shows in the movie. You can see him and watch him, and like, he's got the chops. You know, he knows what he's doing. He belongs on this field. So I think it was a much more like putting on a velvet glove for him. That was just a very comfortable role.
Yes, which is 100% obvious if you're watching it. I equate that to this. People always say that when Jeff Bridges agreed to play Jeffrey Lebowski, a.k.a. the dude in The Big Lebowski, he said it wasn't much of a stretch for him because he kind of does live the life of the dude, much like Rick Vaughn is kind of like what we expect Charlie Sheen to be like in real life. It's not that big of a stretch. Jonathan.
No, not at all.
One of the things you also hit on, which I thought was really fascinating in the book, is that a lot of this movie was shot at Milwaukee's County Stadium. Not a whole lot of it was shot in Cleveland. And why was that? I thought you did a great job of uncovering, you know, why so much of this was shot in a totally different city.
Yeah, and the initial plan was to shoot in Cleveland. They'd always intended to shoot in Cleveland as they were putting the thing together in pre-production, and there were several reasons why they couldn't. First and foremost, it was just financial reasons. It was going to cost a lot more to shoot in Cleveland. But one of the big reasons why they couldn't, probably the biggest reason, was Cleveland Stadium itself. If you remember that mammoth mausoleum on the lake and what that looked like. There were actually some serious lighting problems. It was so cavernous that the sunlight literally wouldn't come through in large portions of the day, even in the middle of the summer. So kind of a symbolic trait of the Indians at the time. The daylight couldn't come through enough for them to film the movie there. And the Browns, of course, by the time they were filming in this part of the summer, this is back in the day when the Browns were sharing the stadium as well. So you'd have had football yard lines on your baseball field, and that's not the optimal visual experience you want in your baseball movie. So they needed to find a stand-in for Cleveland, and kind of scouted around, and Milwaukee was a great fit. It's very similar to Cleveland, kind of that Rust Belt feel, had very optically had a nice range there, a nice landscape to kind of bounce around town and get some different looks. And then County Stadium, as you mentioned, the County Stadium was a very nice stand-in for Cleveland Stadium. Obviously, longtime Cleveland fans look at it and recognize immediately it's not Cleveland Stadium, but boy, it's close. That's about as close as you're going to get, actually designed by the same architects who had designed Cleveland Stadium back in the 30s. So it was a real nice fit, and it really worked out well. Particularly compared to Major League Two, when they, you know, foolishly decided to make Camden Yards play the role of Cleveland Stadium, which was utterly preposterous.
Author Jonathan Knight joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. He's authored many, many great Cleveland sports books, and one of those we're talking about here today, The Making of Major League. And, boy, you know, one of the cool things I think you do here is, again, you pull back the curtain, you talk to all the outstanding personalities that were a big part of making this movie. And, you know, there are some really cool stories that came out of this. One of the fascinating ones for me is that, you know, you learn that one of the enemies in this movie, Pete Vukovic, a.k.a. Clu Haywood, he actually allowed these guys to hang out in one of his bars in Milwaukee. That kind of shocked me that, you know, here you are, you're rooting against Clu Haywood, but then you realize in real life, he was actually helping out a lot along the way. He was helping the guys that were filming this movie hang out and just lay low in his bar. What were some of the other things that kind of came out of this as well for you that were really kind of eye-opening?
Oh yeah, kind of like hanging out with Darth Vader, having a beer after a day of work, right? Yeah. Oh, but yeah, there are a ton of great stories in the book and just out there about filming in Milwaukee. And one of the interesting things too that I didn't really realize until talking to him and getting into and looking at what the schedule was like was, you don't really realize it when you watch the movie, but how much of the action, specifically the baseball action, is filmed at night. And what that means from a movie making perspective is you have to shoot basically all night. So all of these, everyone involved with the movie are on a nocturnal schedule. They're basically working all night long, and then when the sun rises, they go to bed and try and sleep all day, and then get up at night and do it again. So they were, everything was just totally backwards, and your circadian rhythms are completely off. So it was a very, very surreal experience for a lot of these, for everyone basically that was involved in it. So it was, there's some cool stories in there. Yeah, Vukovic was, of course, knew the town and had everybody together, and they were like rock stars, obviously. You know, Hollywood comes to Milwaukee. They hadn't had a movie shot there in 20-something years at that point. So those, you know, Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger just going around town, they had just carte blanche over anywhere they wanted to go. People were going to let them in. So they had a pretty good time that summer in Milwaukee.
Did you get to pick David Ward's brain about the game-winning scene? Because I think it was so awesome, because it was totally unexpected. You know, you think about the ending to all these great baseball movies. Oh, it's the walk-off home run from somebody totally unexpected. To me, what made this movie really awesome, outside the fact that it was made about my favorite baseball franchise, was the way that it ended. I mean, you think about it. The old has-been catcher beating out a bunt. And then, of course, you've got the lightning-quick center fielder standing on second base, scoring from second on a bunt to beat the Yankees. Did you get a chance to pick David Ward's brain about how he put that particular scenario together?
I did, and that was, you're exactly right. I was always just enamored with that ending. I loved it, particularly, you know, setting it up with Jake Taylor calling his shot before, and maybe the first time you see it, you're like, oh boy, here we go. You're just ready for this schmaltzy, totally unrealistic ending. And no, David, of course, is a genius. Like, he's just such a fantastic writer. He wrote The Sting back in the 70s, so, you know, he has some serious, serious writing chops. And talking to him about it, he said, basically, he wanted to avoid that kind of cliched ending. And so much of Major League does that. Like, when you kind of expect it to go this way, it goes that way. And he wanted a dramatic ending, of course, but he just thought, what's a creative way I can get a winning run to score that you've never seen before in a movie or never seen before in a game? Like, that's pretty unusual for somebody to pull something like that off. So he just thought of, okay, what is the craziest way I could do this that would dramatically work, and that's what he came up with, and it worked brilliantly. Like, even now you can watch it, and the way it's crafted and the way it's shot too, I mean, it's beautifully shot. The cinematography of all the baseball stuff is often overlooked, but just so brilliantly done. And that ending, Willie Mays Hayes just swooping across that plate for that winning run, and the slow-mo of Tom Berenger running down the baseline, just really, really well put together and really well thought out by David Ward.
Why were the Indians chosen as the feature in this movie? I never thought about that until this moment.
Well, that's interesting, because I can remember when right around this time, 30 years ago, when the trailers started to come out and you started to hear about this new movie about the Indians, a lot of people were upset that it was the Indians. It was the sense of, oh, somebody's picking on them, like they're making this funny movie and making fun of the Indians. And so Cleveland, of course, you know, their back stiffens up and says, you're picking on my little brother. Like, I can make fun of the Indians, but Hollywood sure isn't going to do it. But in reality, that is not at all what it was. It wasn't like we just picked a team, a bad team in which to tell the story about a bad team. It was, from David Ward's perspective, David Ward grew up in Cleveland. He was an Indians fan and basically came to the realization, like, hey, in the 80s now, this is pre-Jacobs Field, the only way I'm ever going to see the Indians win a championship is if I make a movie in which that happens. So that's what he set out to do. And so that's why the script it's baked in, that it has to be Cleveland, it has to be the Indians. It wasn't like, and that was what he was kind of nervous about too, when it came time to go to Major League Baseball and get the permission to use the team names and all of that sort of thing. There was a real nervous point where it's like, what if they're like, okay, fine, go ahead and make this movie, but you can't have it focus on the Indians. You have to have a fake team or do something else. To David Ward, that would have been a deal breaker. He wasn't going to have a fake team. He couldn't just switch it around to be the Cubs or something like that. It had to be the Indians. So it was always baked into that DNA that it was always going to be Cleveland and always going to be his team.
That's cool.
I think you do an excellent job in this book also of talking about the effect it had on you. As a matter of fact, at one point you mentioned there was a stretch where you went home after school and you would watch Major League every single day. And, you know, I think to the casual fan, the average fan, you know, this certainly became an instant classic. But I think the effect that it had on the rest of baseball certainly is something that cannot be ignored. You talk about it in the book at one point, you know, Sandy Alomar is at spring training, and he points up, and he says, hey, there's Harry Doyle. And, of course, he's pointing at Bob Uecker. That had to be a lot of fun for you also to kind of capture the effect that it had, not only on fans and on the stars that were associated, but also to the Major League Baseball players who kind of took to this as well.
Oh, yeah, and that was a huge part of it. I think that's really kind of the impetus of a big part of the impetus of what kind of drove me to write it in the first place was this wasn't just a successful sports movie or a sports movie that people enjoyed. I mean, this really had an impact, not only in terms of Harry Doyle, we think of Bob Uecker as Harry Doyle, but in the way that so many announcers and broadcasters and anchors, sports anchors, will use Harry Doyle terminology, just dropping it in, not even out, just totally with no context. Like if you totally get it, you know, just a bit outside, things like this. Everybody knows what that means. That what an impact this movie had on the game itself. It's really amazing, and in quiet ways that we don't always think of. One of the big ones is sort of the signature scene of the movie, of course, is Charlie Sheen coming out of the bullpen with Wild Thing blaring on the speakers and the crowd going wild. That basically set the tone for closers having their own theme songs when they would come in. That was not something that was a part of baseball prior to Major League, and that launched that phenomenon that now every, not just closers, every relief pitcher has a song that plays when it comes in. Every batter now has a song that plays as they step up to the plate. That was not at all part of baseball, and now it's a huge part of baseball. And you look at Major League, and that was the pivot point. That's where that all started.
The walkout, man. Now you're right. Everybody's got a walkout song from Major League Baseball all the way down to the college ranks. Everybody's got a walkout song.
Sure.
You're right.
It's
interesting how that just really, really took off. Jonathan, we could talk all day about this movie. We want people to pick up the book, though. I know you're also coming to the area. You're coming to Westlake here over the next few weeks as well. Where can our listeners find you, and what will be happening at your appearance in Westlake?
It's going to be at the Westlake Library March 16th, 2 weeks from this Saturday. They're doing a baseball extravaganza all day long, which is going to be great. So I'll be doing a Major League presentation there that day, showing some clips, some never-before-seen clips and some behind-the-scenes stories. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a great day. So that's Saturday the 16th at Westlake Library. And I'll have, obviously, copies of the book there for signing. You can get the book pretty much anywhere. You can get it on Amazon, any Barnes & Noble in the area. You can find it pretty much anywhere you look for books.
And if you love baseball and if you love that movie, you want to get your hands on this book. It was absolutely fantastic. Jonathan, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate the time, and we hope to see you in a couple of weeks in Westlake.
Thank you, guys. My pleasure.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Again, that's author Jonathan Knight joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. Pick up a copy of that book, Making of Major League. That book was fantastic, man. Like I say, I've got two copies of it at home. It really is terrific. If you like that movie in any way, shape, or form, you're going to love this book.
I think everybody from the Cleveland area enjoys that movie. As he kind of mentioned, it takes that ragtag group of Indians and turns them into champions in the end. Plus, it's an underdog story. Everyone loves the underdog story.
Yeah, and again, the way that movie ended, I mean, just outstanding because it was unexpected, and it was really cool the way they put that together.
It is brilliant. I will say, though, they never actually win the championship in the movie. They win the pennant. They go on to the postseason, and we find out in Major League 2 they come up short in a World Series bid. But I always found that kind of interesting, too, how it just kind of ends there at the end of the season.
We're not going to acknowledge any Major League after Major League 2. Major League 2 is fine, but then number 3 back to the minors, we're not acknowledging.
I don't add Scott Bakula in it.
Nope, never happened. Never happened.
Will they move on to Minnesota?
Yeah, we need to get to a break here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. Coming up in a few, Matt will tell us what's going on with the local news. It's Bullseye on the Afternoon on AM 930 WEOL.
The Cleveland Auto Show is in full swing this week at the IX Center, but you can find the best cars and all the auto show deals a little closer to home at Nick Abraham Elyria Ford. For example, all remaining 2018 Edges are now $10,000 off at Nick Abraham Elyria Ford. Stop in today for the best selection, or stop in and choose from Nick Abraham's selection of remaining 2018 Fusions. Qualified buyers can get 0%, 72-month financing, and $1,000 in bonus cash. Not all buyers will qualify for Ford Credit Limited Term Financing. For all offers, take new retail delivery from dealer stock this week. Stop in. Get the